Welcome to Michigan Writers on the Air, a program about writers, writing, reading, and listening here in northern Michigan. I'm Aaron Stander. In the opening segment, I will be talking with Dr. Jason Kalowish about his new work of historical fiction, Open Wound, The Tragic Obsession of Dr. William Beaumont. This is a story that begins on Mackinac Island. Then Keith Taylor will be here to read from his chapbook, Marginalia for Natural History. At the end, Fleeta Brown will introduce us to the West Coast poet, Catherine Flanagan. It is with pleasure that I welcome Jason Kalowish to Michigan Writers on the Air. Dr. Kalowish is a professor of medicine and medical ethics at the University of Pennsylvania, and the author of a fascinating new piece of historical fiction, Open Wound, The Tragic Obsession of Dr. William Beaumont. Welcome, Jason.
Thank you.
Mackinac Island, 1822. It's 190 years ago, right?
That's right. Yeah.
Could you set the scene for our listeners? What was Mackinac Island like before fudge shops and ferries and tourists and
bicycles
and probably not even many horses?
Well, it was very different than the Mackinac Island of today, and yet there are some enduring aspects of that island. So imagine that fort dominating the place, and imagine the place a cosmopolis of trade. You know, the American Fur Company essentially ruled the island, really, mm-hmm. you know, because they were the principal employer, and Mackinac was the hub for the fur trade. And essentially the Army's job at that point was to keep the island functioning for the American Fur Company. And imagine in June, all the trappers have come with their furs and all the hangers-on and all the et cetera. So imagine instead of what you see now when you're on the top of that fort, which is this verdant park with a statue and whatnot, imagine that just a village of tents and wickups and whatnot, a bit probably crowded and probably a bit dirty, and overseen by the United States Army and with the American Fur Company orchestrating it all. A very different place than now. In fact, I deliberately avoided going there until 2 days ago, because I knew after I looked at some photos of Mackinac that I needed to preserve this imagined world, not the Victorian Mackinac of today.
Mm-hmm. That whole area was a gathering place of Indians and trappers. And
yeah, no, it was a cosmopolis of trade, where they all, you know, given its location.
And what was medicine like at that time? William Beaumont was an assistant surgeon, which you might want to talk about.
Yeah. Yeah, that's an interesting part of his life. But medicine, his time, you know, a typical passage in Beaumont's medical notebook said things like, when pneumonia strikes, apply the lancet, mercurials, and the cup. And what he was basically saying was, bleed them, purge them, make them vomit, and apply a hot cup to what blisters the skin. It was a brutal practice, really, that relied on a theory of disease that basically you either over or understimulated, and mm-hmm. so medicine's task, if you were overstimulated, was to understimulate you, or if you vice versa, and that was essentially the theory that governed all therapeutics. It was a very theory-driven medicine, bore scant relationship today, except in one respect: their understanding about how to take care of broken bones and the basics of wound care and surgery for wounds was not, I would say, contemporary, but it isn't too foreign to some of the basics of today, mm-hmm. which is why Beaumont's become such an important man for Alexis's life.
So at the time, there was a French-Canadian trapper by the name of Alexis St. Martin,
right.
And he was injured in the accidental discharge of a shotgun.
Yes, so on the morning of June in 1822, he's in the American Fur Company supply store, where all the fur trappers would gather to trade goods and gossip and whatnot. And someone sets a shotgun down like a walking stick, and it accidentally discharges. And he unfortunately catches the blast of it on the side of his left side and essentially goes down right away with what looked like, and certainly what was, a horrible gunshot wound. He was a young French-Canadian fur trapper from somewhere around Montreal area, illiterate. young guy, spoke French.
You show this in the book. There are interesting differences between the French, the Americans. The Americans sort of following the English tradition in the way that they looked upon the French.
Yes, no, there was definitely the or the other. And this would play heavily in their relationship, and I think it's something which is sort of lost in the history, unfortunately. Yeah, no, I mean, the term that Americans used to describe French-Canadian fur trappers and French-Canadians in general were gumbos.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a pejorative term, obviously. In fact, at another fort that Beaumont was stationed at in Prairie du Chien, when they would hold performances, the officers and whatnot would hold pantomimes and whatnot, the seating was very hierarchically arranged. Officers up front, enlisted men behind, the villagers behind, and then the French Canadians and slaves in the very rear of the theater. And so this was important because I think this sort of societal attitude about a French Canadian, particularly an illiterate French Canadian, you know, a hyper Catholic, you know, mm-hmm. French Canadian, he was such the other that I think, I think it shaped how Beaumont thought about this young man, particularly when he began to not see him as a patient, but as essentially an object of discovery.
Mm-hmm.
He was somewhat different than his fellow Americans.
And early on, there was a question of how much medical care it even
give
he
him. Deserved. Yeah, yeah. Welcome to healthcare reform in 1820.
He was an indentured servant.
He owed
the company $30 of the $40 that he had.
Yeah. He was an indentured servant was fact. How much he owed, who knows? So this is interesting. At the beginning of the book, I very much took the facts as far as I could
And
then let fiction take over, which is a very interesting, you know, aspect of when you're writing historical fiction. But let's not let the facts get in the way of the truth. I mean, I think what's interesting is that it is true that after Alexis was shot, they left him in the American Fur Company store. Now, the simple thing was, well, he's going to die anyway.
Yes.
But, you know, Beaumont was a military surgeon, and he knew what a military hospital was from a battlefield. And I suppose they let some men mortally wounded perhaps lie on the battlefield. But I think in general it was gather up our fellow soldiers, bring them to the tent and let them die there and do our best to sort of at least relieve their suffering,
mm-hmm.
which they had vague ideas of using opium, for example.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I could never, when I read the history part of it, I couldn't get my head around, why would he say, okay, fine, leave him in the store on a cot, you know, when, I mean, I'm not going to hang out here to be able to minister to his pain.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think the simplest is, oh, well, he's going to die and he'll die quickly. But just thinking as a physician, you know, you wouldn't do that. You'd say, well, we need to have someone at least nearby to make sure he dies comfortably. I mean, even then, notions of comfort were evident. Whether
yes.
they achieved it or not is another matter, and you could even debate that today. So I had to construct, using fiction, what was going on. And that's where I took liberties, where the company basically said, we're not paying for fur trappers who are wounded like this to go to the hospital, because mm-hmm. think of the precedent. You take him there, this beach is full of people like him, and, you know, we can't have this hospital becoming a place for essentially charity stays.
And his commander was on the same page.
Well, of course, because the army backed the American Fur Company. I mean, this was essentially they were one of the same. And what's interesting is that I don't think that fictionalized account is actually too far from the truth, because later the town would not want Alexis around anymore because they were paying for his care,
mm-hmm.
and they were tired of paying for his care. So issues even then of who was owed how much by us, the American people, were an issue, which of course now, you know, we think is a very contemporary issue of courtesy of our social welfare state, but it was there even in.
So for Dr. William Beaumont, the interesting thing was this man had a large wound. It was open to his stomach. It started to, what, I don't quite understand the physiology of this, but at some point the stomach and the abdominal wall
fused
together.
Yeah, exactly.
But so, there was still an opening into the stomach, which allowed him to...
It was a hole under the stomach. If Alexis ate or drank, what he ate or drank would come out that hole, unless it was kept plugged, which Beaumont would do with a lint plug. And at some point, Beaumont realized that what goes out can also go in.
Mm-hmm.
And he began to essentially, I don't want to say play, but just sort of explore. That's the word. He began to just explore. And at some point in his explorations, he realized this is a window into studying the digestion in the stomach. and began to transform this patient who was really a case well done. I mean, his skills as a military surgeon shined on this man. There's no question about that. At some point, he transformed a case well done into a patient who I can study, and then later into other roles, like an employee who I own, a servant who is my charge. But that would come later. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the theory of digestion at that time?
So at that time, you know, so Beaumont was familiar, as a physician might be, courtesy of his reading of the medical textbooks and whatnot, and just talking to colleagues. So what the theories of digestion that floated around were: the stomach was a grinding vat that sort of ground up the food. The stomach was a fermenting vat that sort of fermented it in the way you'd make beer. And there was a bit of a theory that maybe the stomach was actually chemical in what it did. That actually was not undiscovered. It just wasn't accepted. It was controversial. The evidence was ambiguous, just like today in many aspects of science. And so what he figured was, you know what? At some point he decided, I have a window to discovery. If I can now figure out how the stomach works, and I could solve the physiology of gastric digestion, which was no small issue at the time, not just because it's nice to figure out how the body works, but at that time, in particular, digestion was considered sort of the seat of a lot of our character. You know, we even have the phrases today like, you know, you've got no guts, or show some guts, or you're being very splenic and whatnot. Mm-hmm. I mean, those phrases still linger in our vocabulary. Then it was quite dominant, the notion that our emotions came from our guts, whereas our reason came from our brain, you know.
And Beaumont also started to see this as a possible way to move up professionally.
Absolutely. Yeah, his story and is a very sick story.
Well, your story is fascinating. And he's an assistant surgeon, but not really a surgeon.
Exactly.
You know, yeah. So he's one down. There's a real difference in the hierarchy between those doctors who were apprenticed and those who were university trained.
Yeah, exactly. And that was historically correct. I mean, and so he, I think of William Beaumont like the kid that came from a, dare I say, lower middle class family, who went to a state school, you know, paid his way, even a community college, and was desperate, though, to make it in the world, and knew out there were great things for me if I could just work hard and get the things I deserved. So yeah, his medical training, after having been a school teacher for a while and a shopkeeper, was through an apprentice in Vermont. And when he first enlisted in the War of 1812, which was then called the Second War of Independence, he
enlisted to get out of debt.
Yeah, he couldn't get an appointment even as a surgeon's mate. He was an assistant surgeon. His appointment was a surgeon's mate because they said, we won't give a surgeon's appointment or even an assistant surgeon's appointment to someone who's apprentice trained, and that irked him to no end. Mm-hmm. And then he left the army and wanting to become at least an assistant surgeon, they wouldn't give him that. And then years later, after a essentially not terribly successful private practice, he reenlists in the army looking for a steady income, and they only give him assistant surgeon. Mm-hmm. And they won't give him the rank of surgeon. And that always irked him, you know, that he was halfway to what he deserved, which is a line I made up. And that was that aspect of his character, I thought, was very important for me to shape the character. Mm-hmm. You know, this from the beginning desire to become someone better than what I was, which is an American story. I mean, that's the American way, you know, to rise up from your humble roots, you know, as opposed to an aristocratic way where you're born into your station in life and you occupy that, you know.
So along the way, as he continues his career, he gets posted to Prairie du Chien, which sounds like really awful place. But Alexis St. Martin gets sort of dragged along.
Well, sort of a nut, you know. So Beaumont starts experiments on St. Martin and up in Mackinac, basically winging it, having really not a clue what to do. I mean, he truly was doing amateur science, which, you know, was inappropriate. And after a bit of doing that on Alexis runs away.
And which makes perfect sense.
Yeah, spooked him. Yeah. And Beaumont, I'll give you, the way I thought of these two men was like two lovers. Mm-hmm. You know, my beloved fled me. And, you know, a few years later, the fur company finds Alexis up in Canada. And Beaumont just leaps back on this opportunity. By now, he's stationed in Prairie du Chien, which is along the Mississippi,
Wisconsin River.
Yeah. Yep. And he says, bring him back, and I'll send you some money. And Alexis shows up with a wife and children. Mm-hmm. So in between, he'd married and fathered children and had been working. But Beaumont was determined to get this man back, which I thought was fascinating, you know, that he was, you know, I think of the frontier of America up into Canada, and yet they find him.
And it was interesting, too, because you bring in Beaumont's wife and his children, and there's always this tension in his marriage between his sort of devotion to family and sort of devotion to this piece of research that's going to push him forward.
Yeah.
And I guess he could argue, make it better for my family as well.
Right. But in doing it, it was obviously at a cost, which
yes.
was, I mean, you know, Beaumont was like many of us, you know, you want success, you want, and that will be defined by what, you know, my name, my money, my, you know, accomplishments, respect to my peers, but you also want your family and, you know, you want to, you know, you want people who love you and you love them and you want to build a family. And of course, wouldn't we all like to have it all? And even today, of course, I think we all respect how difficult that is.
Yeah.
And his life was a classic study in that. And I did. I brought his wife to life, Deborah. I mean, she emerges from the history as a nothing. In the history, she was little mentioned. But I really brought life to her because, you know, there's no way she enjoyed, you know, his the money he was spending on that man. There's no way she found it, you know, purely fun that they were living in these horrible conditions, you know, with this French Canadian who really wasn't a very good servant hanging around them because her husband wanted to study him. Later, he would leave to go to, he thought Paris, but
yes.
ended up in Washington. And I wanted her to sort of speak truth to his power. You know, he had the power over the family, as especially in those days. But I wanted her to say, you know, you got to think about us too,
mm-hmm.
you know. Yeah, absolutely.
So why don't we move to that Washington place let's talk a couple of things. First of all, he was going there to get, or he was hoping to go to Paris.
Exactly. Yeah.
Where and he was going to take Alexis St. Barton with him, and he would be welcome to the scientific salons of Europe, and they would appreciate.
Yeah. Yeah. This was a real. Yeah. Before we go to Washington, I mean, Beaumont at his lowest point, he had his sort of highest moment of inspiration, and the history records this that at some point in their time in Prairie du Chien, Beaumont decides, I got to get the heck out of America. I got to get out of this military commission and devote myself to studying this guy. The experiments he did in Prairie du Chien were over almost a two-year period were very few. They weren't very focused. And you could clearly tell he was kind of realizing, I got to get out of this. And he cooked up the plan in Prairie du Chien to go to Paris, which was the mecca of medicine at the time. And to get this, take Alexis with him and study him in Paris, and was given permission by his commanding officer back in Washington, a surgeon, Joseph Lovell, to do that. And part of the background that I also felt why he wanted to go to Paris and do this was he'd been witnessing, you know, the treaties making and breaking of the treaties with the Indians and the way we were essentially destroying the Indian. And I kind of used the inspiration that he might have seen there of, you know, you can make just so many deals with people that are not of your type,
yes.
and you just got to finally control them. And because it is after Prairie du Chien that Beaumont is determined to control Alexis fully. You know, prior to that, it was, I'll pay you a little bit of money. At this point, when they're heading to Washington, he draws up a complex set of articles and agreement that are read like a legal contract, that Alexis, who's illiterate, certainly doesn't speak English quite well, puts his ex on. He ultimately enlists him in the army as well, because obviously, if he deserted, he'd have the army now going after mm-hmm. him, as opposed to just Beaumont with a bat with a broken contract. So at this point, Beaumont is seeking total control of this man.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you are mine, in the same way a servant is the master's property, you know, or even, frankly, a slave.
Yeah, yeah. And yet he gets to Washington and...
the great disappointment.
The great disappointment.
Your furlough, because of budget cuts, so this is 1830s, the Jackson administration is dealing with a rapidly declining economy, and so they're cutting the budget. And so they the idea of taking a year-long sabbatical is just not acceptable. And so the best Surgeon Lovell can do is say, I'll give you 6 months. And that's not enough time to go to Paris. So
mm-hmm.
Beaumont
Especially then.
Yeah, exactly.
It would take the entire time. Just
yeah.
to...
So Beaumont quickly recalibrates his plans and says, okay, we're going to stay in Washington in the barracks here, and I'm going to devote myself to studying you here in Washington in the naval barracks. Yeah.
So could you read part of that?
Yeah. So they're settled in Washington now into the barracks. You know, so Beaumont's wife and children are back up in Plattsburgh, New York. So they're, Alexis's wife and children are up in Canada. So these two men are in their this barrack where Beaumont has dedicated himself to studying Alexis. Now came days of experiments. Beaumont constructed his synoptic tables to show the scientists to be like the fanatical preachers of the New York State, splintering each other's dogma with the axe of a new theory, then gathering and chopping the facts to fit a new theory. Each seemed equally correct, and each seemed equally deficient. Ramor retrieved his gastric juice from sponges he forced buzzards to swallow. Young studied frogs and his own vomit. Spencer used dogs. What none of them possessed was the plain and unvarnished truth, unfettered by the heirlooms of theory and the crude observation of lesser animals. None of them had Alexis and his endless supply of gastric liquor. In time, their rooms became a factory of discovery, and Alexis was fully transformed. Beaumont came to see only the experiments at hand. Alexis's thin body became like a patent machine centered at the puckered hole. The variations in experiments were as numerous as every act, every motion, every mood and meal his Frenchman experienced. He placed masticated portions of food into a vial of gastric juice, and into another of pure water, and still a third vial with unmasticated food into saliva he ordered Alexis to spit up. Then he ordered Alexis to cradle these vials in his armpits as he performed his chores or took his customary walk from the barracks to the dockyard and back. Beaumont allayed Alexis's sense of hunger, croaking noises caused by the motion of air in the stomach and intestines, by putting directly through the aperture 3.5 drachms of lean boiled beef. The next day he introduced 8 ounces of lukewarm beef and barley soup through a tube with a syringe. Scientific efficiency governed their every action.
And this all became a book?
Yeah. So to his credit, you know, mind you, this man, he has no formal training at all in research. And you say, well, who had formal training in research? Well, certainly by the standards of today, perhaps no one. But yet there were people who were researchers, who wrote textbooks of physiology. Robley Douglinson was a physiologist at the University of Virginia who Beaumont met. So Beaumont, on his own, figures out how to do what he does, a lot of trial and error. And he is determined to write a book, which he does. He writes a book that he authors. He writes it. Divided up into chapters about digestion, as what he observed, and recording every single one of his experimental results. And the book is called by the fascinating title Experiments and Observations of the Gastric Juice and the Physiology of Digestion. And he put it out.
At his own expense.
Yes, as was the Nate custom back then.
Yes, you would find subscribers, and you would hope that you would sell enough to cover the cost of...
Yep, and Beaumont, classic to Beaumont, for example, you know, he wanted to have some pictures of the wound in the book, and the method of choice, especially for an anatomic picture, would be an etching done on metal.
Yes.
Those would be expensive, of course, Beaumont being... a very frugal man all his life, decided to have a woodcut. And if you look at the woodcuts, you figure them out after a while, but you realize why woodcuts are not the most of the finest often of renderings of something. So he puts his book out, and he has great hopes and plans for it. You know, don't all authors have such great hopes and plans? And you know, he hoped that the Army would buy 100 copies and the Navy 100 copies. Each service would only buy one, you mm-hmm. know. He hoped that the public would embrace it as a book as well, which even at the time, it wasn't written in any way, actually, that would give the public practical advice. I mean, you really had to struggle to figure out, oh, okay, I guess I should chew my swallow and all these other sort of things. It was really written as kind of a diary of digestion, you know. But if you worked, you could find true insights. I mean, he did discover the chemical nature of digestion, or I should say he sealed that as being a fact. Mm-hmm. But there was a whole lot of other stuff in the book that he had in there. I'll just leave you one thing. I mean, he became obsessed about timing, the time it took to digest various articles of food, you know, both in the stomach and in these vials of gastric juice that he collected. And he recorded in these endless tables, these synoptic tables of digestion. And they were all totally useless because he never wrote down the weight. Mm-hmm. So he had no idea, you know, well, pork takes 3 hours. Well, how much? Yeah. So, you know, so, but that's the kind of, that was his style. You know, he was
now, you suggest in the book that he was criticized and greatly hurt by that. Is this conjecture on your part, or did you?
No, you could. He had a He had a temperament, which is probably why he was able to do what he did, but also was his curse, as is often the case with men who really, and women who strive to do great things. The things that are their strengths are also the things that are harmful, you know, like a lion's tooth, you know, or a claw, you know. He did not tolerate anyone that would stand in his way or criticize him, and he would go after you. Hellbent for his side, you know. He tried to challenge a guy to a duel once, etc. So he was criticized by a physiologist for his work, and boy did he get furious, you know, the letters exchanged and whatnot. And when critics would criticize the book or his methods, he would be furious, you know. He did not tolerate criticism at all.
This is a work of fiction.
Absolutely, yeah.
It reads like a novel. Along the way you bring in historical characters, change. Dred Scott makes a cameo appearance.
Yes, at one point. I like doing that one.
Yeah, because you're trying to show the difference between Alexis St. Martin and Dred Scott.
Yeah. But that wasn't outrageous, you know. So that's an interesting exercise. I've talked with other writers about this. You know, it's kind of, once you set the rules of fiction in motion for a book, they're as strict as the rules of an experiment.
Yeah.
And the rule of fiction here, you know, demanded that, you know, well, he should see the world of masters and slaves and in some way reflect on that, because that's what he was doing to his patient. He was turning his patient essentially into a slave. And so I also knew that Emerson, Dr. Emerson, was the owner of Dred Scott. Mm-hmm. And Dr. Emerson was a military physician. And I thought it was plausible that they would have met, you know, at the same time. There were just so many forts and whatnot. And so that I made up, though, that they met. But
it works perfectly, and it makes the story rich, and it brings a certain kind of truth to the story, even though it's fiction.
Dr. Emerson says to him, you know, you ought to get yourself a proper servant, like what I've got, not one of these lazy French gumbos.
And then at the end, this is very much a fictional approach, a novel approach to tie this whole book up and to sort of finish the character. You have the trial of William Daines and Andrew Davis.
Yeah, yeah.
And it goes back to all of Beaumont's insecurities and...
This was true.
By this point, he is a very highly regarded physician. He is wealthy.
He had achieved finally... It's interesting. He is a story of, you know... Remember, our Declaration of Independence is life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It says nothing about the attainment of happiness. And it is in the pursuit, perhaps, that really we should only seek our happiness. Because Beaumont did finally attain what, by all his respects, if you told him as a young man he would obtain, he would have said, if you can give me that, I will be happy. And what was that? That was a lucrative practice in the city of St. Louis. He was essentially a celebrity physician because of the fame from his book, even though it didn't relate much to his practice. But he was a busy practitioner making a lot of money. He owned a house. He owned property, which in those times was a substantial achievement. He had a wife and kids who lived in this wonderful house with servants and a piano teacher and a tutor. I mean, he was doing really well. And yet it was very clear to me, reading his letters and his writings, that he was not happy.
Mm-hmm.
And why wasn't he happy became sort of the goal of the book. You know, what is it about this man that had him do everything he did and yet in the end essentially not be happy? And one of the events that helped, I think, begin to explain that is this case, this Darnes Davis affair. And so what the case was, this case was a real case that really occurred, that Beaumont was really drawn into, which was the politician William Daines from Missouri had been infuriated by the newspaper man Andrew Davis's editorials criticizing Daines. And Daines attacks this editor in the street and beats him on the head with an iron cane into unconsciousness. And Beaumont is called in as one of several surgeons to minister to this ultimately mortally wounded editor. The politician Darnes goes to trial for third degree murder. And this is all true. The defense attorney calls William Beaumont as an expert witness to the cause of the editor's death, and what he does to Beaumont, and I found the oration is brilliant. He uses Beaumont's own fame and reputation against him to make the case that the newspaper editor died at the hands, not of the wound inflicted by the
assailant,
but rather by the work of this eager, greedy, ambitious, and sees his patients as objects of experiment.
Mm-hmm.
And this this attorney's summation to the jury was so successful and popular in the legal community that it was reprinted in a penny pamphlet and distributed throughout America amongst lawyers as an example of sort of a great way to sort of argue a case. It almost, in some sense, presages what would subsequently be the field of medical malpractice.
Mm-hmm. I mean,
at the time, medical malpractice was really an unknown area.
Exactly.
It would become, obviously, a very prominent area. By the late 19th century, medicine and law were definitely fields that were in opposition. And I read that. I read, my God, this sounds like a brilliant piece of medical mal summation in a Philadelphia courtroom you could hear today. And Beaumont was furious from that. Absolutely furious. Absolutely furious. And I think it was one of many events that were occurring at the end of his life where he was realizing the one thing I value the most is threatened. And it wasn't the money. It frankly wasn't his family and the kids. It wasn't his medical practice even.
Mm-hmm.
It was his reputation, particularly his reputation in posthumous time. And he wrote in one of his letters to his brother, "Should posthumous time remember my name, let historic truths proclaim my fame." And I remember when I read that, I said, this is it.
Mm-hmm.
This guy's pitching for history. You know, the immortality of fame. You know, this is an American, not someone who's enamored of sort of, you know, life in the hereafter. You know, he wasn't a very religious man. And so his whole, you know, I'm going to be gone, and will anyone ever remember me for what I did? And he was just distraught, for example, when he read a physiology textbook which referred to him as the late Dr. Beaumont. So they thought he was dead. He wasn't.
He was just hiding in St. Louis.
Exactly, exactly. And so, you know, much like you read today, people who have, you know, achieved great things, it becomes an insatiable passion, you know, or if as I said in the book, a tragic obsession, you know.
Well, it's an absolute wonderful read.
Well, thank you.
It reads like fiction. I mean, it reads like a novel that you cannot set down.
Oh, wow.
And I was swept away with it. Readers can find more information about you at your website.
Yes, yes. I have a website. It's www.jasonkarlawish, so JasonKarlawish.com. And so obviously it talks about the book, but talks about my other work too.
The book again is Open Wound, The Tragic Obsession of Dr. William Beaumont. Jason Karlawish, thank you so much for being here.
You're very welcome. It was a pleasure, Aaron.
You're listening to Michigan Writers on the Air on IPR News Radio. Poet and writer Keith Taylor is here. Welcome, Keith. Good seeing you again.
And you too, Aaron. Always a pleasure.
Keith coordinates the undergraduate program in creative writing at the University of Michigan and directs the Bear River Writers Conference. And you're also the poetry editor of Michigan Quarterly.
I am now, yes.
Just keep adding those jobs, don't they?
You got to make a living. I have a child at an expensive college.
And today you're here to talk about this wonderful little chapbook, Marginalia for a Natural History. And as I was reading this book and thinking about the poems and the title, Marginalia, do you think that's going to disappear in an electronic age?
Well, you know, you hope that it doesn't. You hope that it doesn't, but it may indeed. I mean, there's still some of us dinosaurs around who put our marginalia in our little books. And, of course, those of us who use field guides.
Yeah.
And, of course, you're always making notes in field guides. And if you are a writer and you have a field guide, you are often stimulated to write things that have nothing to do with the bird or the insect mm-hmm. or the tree that you're mm-hmm. looking at. And of course, now you got people with their guides on their smartphones and things. So what's going to happen to the marginalia? I don't know.
They probably will record it.
Well, maybe. Maybe. I don't see them doing it yet.
But we'll stick to the text.
Exactly. Yeah. No, I don't know.
And in the summer, you also teach an environmental writing
class. I do. I teach a class for the University of Michigan Biological Station. This is the seventh summer that I've done that. It's a two-month class. That's up on Douglas Lake, northeast of Petoskey. The university's had a 10,000 acres up there for 100 years. They got the land just after it had been burned over and after everything had been logged, and they've been just watching that forest regrow for more than a century now, measuring it, recording it. A lot of what we know about climate change in the northern forest, they've learned there. And for some reason, they wanted me there. And I jumped at the chance.
So did these poems come from?
They did. They really started there. A lot of them are dedicated to actual field biologists who work there. Probably the first one that I wrote is dedicated to a guy named Phil Myers. Phil Myers is a mammalogist from the University of Michigan. He does the mammals at the Museum of Natural History down in Ann Arbor, but he also teaches up there. And Phil was giving a lecture on the mice that he trapped in the Lower Peninsula, the white-footed mouse in particular. And in the 30 years he'd been trapping that mouse, it used to stop right about the middle of the mitten, but it had been progressively moving north, and the deer mouse had been progressively retreating. Until now, in the last several years, he's found only white-footed mice, and the deer mouse is only in the Upper Peninsula.
Really?
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
So I was listening to this lecture, and I was thinking, all the things we hear about climate change, the melting ice caps, the opening of the Northwest Passage, all those things, but nobody ever talks about the mouse, you know, it's a little thing. So I was writing this, and often when I organize things, I hate to admit this to you, Aaron, but I will simply count syllables, that good old-fashioned syllabic count, just to get going.
Mm-hmm.
So I was writing all these lines down, and everyone had 9 syllables per line. And then I cut out all the introductory matter, and I just kept "Not the Northwest Passage" as the title. And then I had these lines. So I'll read them if that's okay. So this is dedicated to Phil Myers, who's professor of mammals at University of Michigan. "Not the Northwest Passage, just the white-footed mouse, delicate and doe-eyed, only 25 grams of unrelenting passion pushing north, a few feet each generation, through duff on the forest floor. Old logs or tunnels under deep snow, always north, attacking the necessary and impenetrable wall of cold." So that, and I cut that out and I said, well, that's, you know, 9 syllables per line and 8 lines. That's kind of okay. The very next day, I mean, literally, within 24 hours, I was sitting in the cafeteria with these field biologists. There's a woman named Ola Fink. She's from the University of Oklahoma. She's studied damselflies in northern Michigan for 30 years, the tiny little, smallest of the dragonflies.
Well, they wings fold over the body instead of...
Exactly. And they're the little darters, and they move around, and they're gorgeous blue. But I saw one, and it was green, and it had black wings. It was over Horton Creek, Hemingway's Creek. And the light was going through the black wings, hitting the water, flashing back on this luminous green body, and everything turned turquoise. And I went to her. I said, you know, Ola, I saw this damselfly I've never seen before. I described it. She says, oh, you've seen that everywhere. You've seen that from the Huron River in Ann Arbor to the Two-Hearted River in the Upper Peninsula. And, of course, once I knew the name, I saw it everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, it's the ebony jewel-winged damselfly. Well, if you put those syllables on your fingers, you end up with 9 syllables. And I'm thinking, Aaron, I'm thinking, the gods are giving me this, but I think I should probably respond. So this was the second one. These are not the 1 and 2 in the book. And, of course, I put it at the Two-Hearted, and there's quotations in the last line. The last 5 words are from the second paragraph of Hemingway's story, by the way, so which is always going to, for, you know, people like you and me, I suspect your listeners, is probably always going to be associated with that river. So this was the next one. "At the Two-Hearted, just flitting around the eye's corner, but only seen when I learned the name, ebony, jewel-winged damselfly, luminous detail, down low in shade, or catching quick moments of sunlight on his green body, light reflecting up through black gossamer wings, flashing turquoise into the clear brown water." So suddenly I had this thing, and these 9-syllable lines, and this one too ended up being 8 lines long. So I had this form, and I was able to go back and find lots of these things I wanted to write about, things I talked about with Traverse City writer Jared Dennis over the years. I ended up dedicating this little book to Jared Dennis, and sticking a lot of sciencey kinds of things in here, or at least a lot of the Northern Forest, with some digressions. And I call it marginalia for a natural history because I don't know how you use your field guides, but I'll have them and I'll make notes, and I'll make notes about what I'll see, and then I'll remember something from 35 years ago when I lived in Paris, and I'll make that little note too, and forget about it for a decade,
come back to it.
So all of those things get stuck in here, and I hope they hang together. I like to think that they do. A lot of these poems are also dedicated to people. Most of whom are field biologists, but not all of them. Most of whom are associated with the university's biological station up there outside Pelston, but not all of them. So I had that sort of sense that they were all kind of connected, and they were connected to a group of people, and these people were all part of my intellectual life and imaginative life.
Well, they certainly are rich.
Well, thank you.
So how did Pete Becker fit into this?
Oh, well, Pete Becker, we should... Pete A.L. Becker. For those
anthropologist?
Pete was a linguist. And he used to call himself, and he said, I'm a 19th century philologist, as opposed to being a linguist of the Chomsky variety. He liked Chomsky's politics, but he didn't like Chomsky's linguistics. He was from Monroe, Michigan. Did all his life, came to University of Michigan as an 18-year-old, went through his PhD, and ended up a professor emeritus there. Did his academic work with South Asian languages.
Yes.
Spoke 17 of these Asian languages, difficult languages, all with different alphabets and things, but was also deeply a passionate canoer who was up in the UP and up in Northern Ontario almost every summer when he was on this continent, going on 2-3-4-week canoe trips up toward Hudson Bay or coming back down toward Lake Huron. Luckily, before he got too frail to do this, he invited me along, and I went with him and his wife. This is some of your people will remember a textbook that was all a composition book that was always referred to as Young Becker Pike. So he's the Becker of that textbook.
Particle, field, wave.
Very good. Very good. Yes. Whoa. We won't try to explain that. That would go on forever. So they took me up there. So this was the third poem I wrote there because I wanted to write a poem dedicated to them. I wanted to recognize where they'd taken me and what this far northern landscape they'd introduced me to. And Pete and I, one time we spent 3 weeks together in a canoe, and we would joke that people go looking for the Garden of Eden or what's left of the Garden of Eden between the Tigris and the Euphrates. But if he or I were the Lord God Almighty, we'd want to hide the gate to the Garden of Eden someplace where unexpected, where people wouldn't look. Say, for instance, the Northern Forest. So this was our little the poem that came about that. Passage to Eden. It's dedicated to Pete and Judith Becker. Just to let you know that the true gate to paradise is on an island in a small lake, some far northern place, protected by 7 months of cold and ice, then 4 more of mosquitoes, black flies, armies of them, wolves and bear if you're feeling brave. A few of us know where it is, but we're not telling. So then, the things that stimulate these poems. So here's one. This is a true story, Aaron, for you, for your fond memories of Ann Arbor. You'll recognize the landscape. I suspect some of your listeners will too. So this is Ann Arbor on Christmas Eve, and it's just, I'm writing these things about creatures and insects and bugs in northern Michigan, and suddenly on Christmas Eve, in a snowstorm, I see a camel. How bizarre is that? So that had to become a poem. So this is At the Living Creche. A camel in the churchyard on State walked around the fence toward our car. This is true. It really did happen. Late Christmas Eve, after I picked up Faith and Christine from Mass, and he bent down to stick his head in the window. Snow collected on his pelt. The steam and stench of camel breath filled the air.
And that was the question I was asking when I read it. Is this true?
That one is that absolutely true. And in a Michigan snowstorm, it's got to be animal cruelty or something to have a camel in a Michigan snowstorm on Christmas Eve. So those kinds of things were fun. Then, of course, there's this, you start looking for these things. I was over in England. Doing a book of Greek translations that I did, and I had some time, and I went to the British Museum. Hadn't been there in years. They have one room in the British Museum that's an attempt to reproduce sort of an 18th century collection, all those weird things that are in 18th century collections. So I saw this one too, and it seemed strange. They used to call those cabinets of curiosities. A great phrase, has to be a title. So, in a cabinet of curiosities, hidden in the British Museum, yes, in a dark and dusty corner, two shelves up from the floor, a merman, brown, mummified, less than 2 feet long, holds his skeletal hands to his head and grimaces. He's been drying there for 250 years now. The scales on his tail are flaking off. He really was there.
He was really there.
He was there. Yeah. Now, and he looks pretty good. You know, it's
for 200 years
for 200 year old merman. Yeah, and you kind of think, and he's probably about 2 feet high. And you got to think it was a small the torso and head of a small monkey put into the tail of a rather large fish.
Ah,
that's what you think. But of course,
who knows?
Who knows? Maybe it was a merman. My scientific colleagues probably wouldn't like that. Then, of course, then you know, the personal elements that get in, I mean, they're just impossible to do. I have a wonderful daughter, senior at Kalamazoo College, smart, beautiful, but she's narcoleptic. You know, when she was a kid, we would just sort of say, well, you know, turn your phone off and go to bed, get a good night's sleep, until finally she insisted that, no, I have something different than all my friends do, and we had her diagnosed and tested, and she was a complete narcoleptic. So we've been dealing with that, and she's been dealing with it quite well. So that ended up too, one of these things sort of in the margins of everything else, my daughter's narcolepsy. Before we received the official diagnosis, we loved to recount her sleep episodes. My favorite, the Louvre, in front of those gigantic paintings David made, celebrating the coronation of Josephine and Napoleon before the French nobles. My daughter drooled on the bench.
It's a wonderful poem.
Thank you.
I think we have time for about one more.
One more? Well, let me read the last poem in the book. This is a real Northern Michigan poem. This is my image of the North. The lake is actually Douglas Lake up there, just north of Burt Lake. Canoeing at Dusk, very romantic poem, Canoeing at Dusk. I am a student in the landscapes of light, alone on a quiet lake as clouds fade from pink to gray, as green shores darken into night. Watery reflections, quickly shifting puddles of purple half-light, play on the waves I paddle through, first catching the last hint of day, and then the waning moon.
Wow. Beautiful.
Thank you.
So people can find out more about you by going to your website.
I have a website, www.keithtaylorannarbor.com. All run together, Keith Taylor Ann Arbor. There's a lot of Keith Taylors in the world. So,
and in fact, I think it's easier to just Google Keith Taylor Ann Arbor.
Yes, I think you can find me right away. Now.
And they can find this book where?
This book is around. It's actually in some bookstores here up north. I know it's in the Brilliant bookstores in Traverse City and Sutton's Bay. I think there might be some copies at Horizon. I think there's some copies at McLean and Eakin up in Petoskey, and it's certainly in Ann Arbor at Nicholas Books and places like that.
It's just a wonderful read and a fun book, and it's always great to have you here. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Aaron. It's great to be here.
Fleta Brown is here, having fought her way through the holiday traffic. Welcome, Fleta.
Hi, Aaron. Yes, I did fight my way, but once you get toward Interlaken, it's not so bad. I would like to introduce you to the work of Kathleen Flanagan. She's the current poet laureate of the state of Washington. Her new book is called Plume, from the University of Washington Press, 2012. And she tells the story in poems of what happened at Hanford Nuclear Reservation in the desert of eastern Washington, where her father worked, and of Richland, which is its bedroom community where she grew up during the Cold War. She worked at Hanford herself for 3 years. She's a civil engineer and a hydrologist and a poet. She knows what she's talking about. I thought of this book because of the concern in this part of the country and everywhere about getting the natural gas out of the ground by fracking, which deposits a chemical concoction deep in the ground that can creep its flumes toward the large bodies of water. We're told, of course, by the gas companies that this is safe. Kathleen's poems are based on her experience and reams of declassified documents that reveal decades of environmental contamination and deception at the plutonium production facility, where families were assured that all was well and that they were safe. They focus specifically on her friend Carolyn's father, who dies of radiation poisoning. Here's a poem about that. It's called Self-Portrait with Father as Tour Guide. You're 18. It's August, brim to brim, and your father is at the wheel. He points proudly at distant reactors and spires, sun-baked highway, and barbed wire, and offers them to you. You've waited all your life. A gate patrolman waves you across the threshold into the Cold War world. You grew up downstream, sugared by these winds, while Dad and Carolyn's dad and every father you knew disappeared to fuel the bomb. He drives you past canyon buildings like grounded ocean freighters. A dozen miles more and White Bluffs shimmers into view, a ghost town with your very own eyes, a shell of old Hanford High School, sad remnants of abandoned farms. Dad is pointing, but wind and speed carry his voice away. Look at me, trying to retrieve him across 3 decades. Kathleen, girl I used to be, enjoy your afternoon. Flash your one-day badge at jackrabbits and coyotes. If he's dead now, if all the fathers will soon be dead, know they made their mark. They'll matter for centuries. I admire these poems on many levels. The poems avoid being political cliché. It's a scary book, but the poems turn what could be a one-faceted rant into the personal, the lyric, and the memoir. They expose all forms of damage, not just the physical damage of radiation, but of human blindness and ordinary human failings. She slightly deflects the fear so that it enters the reader poem by poem as slowly and subtly as radiation. The siren sounds deep in my lizard brain, Flanagan writes in a poem called Siren Recognition, as the deadly plume of the tidal seeps upward into the rivers. In another poem called Song of the Secretary, Hot Lab, the secretary is slowly irradiated at her desk because a lab technician accidentally moved some bricks on the other side of the wall. As readers, we have to face the horrible truth in the same way, bit by bit. There are poems in this book in traditional forms, and there are poems that sound like nursery rhymes. There are blocks of official prose, big blocks of official prose with large areas censored out with black over them to reveal a truth that the original didn't want to say. The poems, one by one, change forms. They're sometimes flattening into prose. There are some prose passages. There's a feeling that the many forms are searching, going at the issue as many ways as possible, looking for answers like a researcher. I'd like to end with this poem, which seems to encompass the entire world of the book. I can easily remember this world, and I'll bet you can too. We had bomb drills, but of course they were called civil defense drills. Did you get down under a desk also?
Absolutely.
Well, they lined us up along the wall in the hallway also, with our all tucked down, with our hands over our heads and crouched, and we were supposed to stay there for a certain length of time.
Did you have little plastic IDs with your blood type?
Oh, no, that was fancier. No,
we had those too.
So we were supposed to be protected by this. And this poem is called The Cold War. It will turn quaint soon enough. Bomb shelters already charm us, stuffed to their low ceilings with batteries, board games, and cans. Sardines are amusing. And pineapple rings for dessert. Old footage of duck and cover drills inspire us to be world-weary and ironic, to embrace the futile. Once we considered A-bombs big, then H-bombs exploded over the South Pacific. We can laugh now at Khrushchev and his shoe, beauty queens in radiation suits. I'd wake bolt upright in my bed, afraid of a flash to come. I'd buy books and extra spaghetti to provide for our last days and pray that our end be painless. I wasn't even that young. I remember the red phone and missile codes, how every movie hinged on a clock ticking down. We called it the arms race, and there were two sides. It was simple. Kathleen Flanagan is a skilled poet, and this is a gripping book. The book is Plume from the University of Washington Press, 2012.
Interesting. Thank you so much, Flita. Thank you for listening to Michigan Writers on the Air. I'm grateful to Jason Karlowish, Keith Taylor, and Flita Brown for their time. Also, kudos to Brock Mormon, Brad Aspie, and Peter Payette, all of whom bring great knowledge and skill to the engineering and production of this show. This program is a production of Interlochen Public Radio. Be sure to listen next month to Michigan Writers on the Air on IPR News Radio. Until then, I wish you great writing, great reading, and the best of all words.